Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the debate over climate change may continue outside of the realm of science, within the scientific community, work is more oriented towards documenting climate change's effects, both today and in the past, even the very distant past. Today's guest has focused her work on documenting how environmental changes during the past 2 million years may have affected human development, evolution, and cultural development. Dr. Miriam Bellmaker is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Tulsa and a paleoanthropologist who uses the remains of small rodent species to determine environmental effects on human communities and as well as their evolutionary ancestors. She's currently working on a number of sites ranging from Beit Sida, a northern Israeli site along the Sea of Galilee, a site which she's actively looking for students and community members to dig at, as well as another northern Israeli site, Amud Cave, which housed a Neanderthal community, to Gorhaik, a site in Armenia, which might be one of the earliest modern human sites. You can learn more about the Beit Sida dig at the Center for Global Education at the University of Tulsa. And Dr. Bellmaker joins us today to talk about her work, both in the field and in the lab. Miriam Bellmaker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the thrust of your work. Your work is... it's a very different side of environmental change. You're looking back at environmental change going back to almost, 2 million years ago?
Something like that, 2.5 million.
So how can we determine how environmental changes happened about 2 million years ago?
Well, I look at environmental change from a very unique, very small micro perspective. And what I look at is micro mammals or rodents and shrews and very small things. Most people look at environmental change looking at chemicals and chemistry and waves and climate.
Or tree growth.
Growth and stuff like that, exactly. And I actually look at the rodents. My idea, and especially what rodents ate at that time period, is that rodents are all around us. As you know, they're very, very numerous. So they're also numerous in archaeological sites and paleontological sites. So we find a lot of them. And they're very, very indicative of climate change. They're very, very sensitive to all these little fluctuations in climate change.
In what ways?
So, for example, if climate change changes very subtly between getting warmer or colder, the community of rodents is going to change, and not only change in what types of rodents change, but also what they ate. And we can track what they ate, looking at changes on the wear of their teeth, for example. We have a unique microscope here that we just received in Tulsa that allows us to do that. So we're really a center for looking at that kind of stuff. And when we look at both the types of rodents that we have, what things they ate, we can start looking at climate change at a very small, very micro level at key events in human evolution starting from 2.5 million years ago all the way up to yesterday.
Really? When you're looking at rodents, I assume you're looking at large populations of rodents, or can you make these as assumptions and hypothesis based on just a few animals?
Well, we can try it, you know, smaller scales, you know, beginning around, you know, I say 25 rodents is a little small. but, you know, we aim to look at larger populations, really depending on what you find. We're trying to encourage archaeologists, especially at the later time periods at some of the excavations that I'm working at, to start looking for rodents. And I think this is one of the things I'm most proud of. Some of the later time periods of excavations that I'm working at, such as Beit Sida. This is a site that TU belongs to a large consortium of 11 universities. And the site is a very, quote-unquote, late site for me because it ranges from the 10th century BC all the way to the Roman period, a little even later than the Roman period. And so it's very late. And up to now, people didn't look for rodents in these kinds of sites because they ignored them. They said, you know, we're not going to find them. And it's very wasteful in time in terms of manpower and money to sit all day long and sieve through a very, very fine eighth of an inch mesh to look for these rodents. And here in this Beit Sida, we actually put together a program in which we look for these rodents and trying to look for climate change at the time of when Jesus was in Beit Sida. Beit Sida was mentioned in the New Testament and in the Old Testament, and which is extremely exciting. And we're taking students to Beit Sida both to excavate in the old style with a shovel and in our new style with actually a sieve and to look for rodents.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. But let's get back to that idea of when you're looking at something like 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, 200,000 years ago, are you going to see rodent remains?
Absolutely. Actually, quite a few, more than any other animal. Rodents are accumulated in archaeological sites, usually by raptors such as barn owls. That's the most common raptor, maybe eagle owls, either in caves, which is where humans also live. So that's where barn owls live. And they, pardon me, regurgitate pellets with their prey. Uh-huh. And you have accumulations. We have a cave in Israel called Hayonim Cave. And there you have a small area of about 2 feet by 2 feet where you have accumulations of rodents that basically a barn owl, well, not the same barn owl, but barn owls, generations of barn owls stood there on the ledge and regurgitated, you know, on the same location, spot after spot, spot after spot for 200,000 years, accumulated rodents. And just, I would say, in the hundreds of thousands of remains.
Now, I've never been on an archaeological dig or anthropological dig. 99% of people probably haven't. What do you find at say, some of these sites where you're digging? I would assume you're finding everything from, you're finding trash, you're finding, you know, just everything about
Absolutely.
It.
Yeah. So in the earlier sites, before, let's say, the Bronze Age, we find everything from food trash, which is animal bones that people ate. So that's really interesting. We find remains of, if it's very early and people before domestication, it's the remains of what people ate or hunted. So it's gazelles, it's wildebeest, it's, you know, larger animals, but they're usually all chopped up and we can learn a lot about what they ate and the types of foods.
We also learn about the tools they
and
use.
And the tools. And then we have, of course, I was going to mention the tools, and these tools are made out of stone. Sometimes they're made out of chert, sometimes made out of obsidian, like the site in Armenia that I have, which 100% of the tools are made out of obsidian. Then we have types of trash later on when we start having domesticated animals and we start having also plant remains. You have the plant remains, wheat and barley, and domesticated animals like sheep and goat. When you start getting into the era when we start having metal and coin exchange like Beit Saida, which I was talking about, the fun part, and that's the part where, you know, it's not for me because, I mean, for my research, but it's fun as a, just a human being, we start finding gold coins or even bronze coins. And, you know, last year when I was in the excavation, we found a gold coin, a Herodian gold coin. And, you know, as a human being, it's always, you know, the idea of Indiana Jones and you're going there and you find a gold coin. It's always very, very exciting. And then you find ceramics. People started making ceramics around 20,000 years ago. And you start finding remains of trash and ceramics. From there, you learn a lot about the culture and you actually sit down and be put together just like, you know, you can imagine from archaeological sites putting back together pots and pans and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And
right.
What people made. So it really depends on what time period you're going to. And it can be anything from, you know, using a dental pick, which we have, and I get them from my dentist. They think I'm crazy, but, you know, my dentist gives me all, you know, dental picks that we can use. And going to using a shovel and actually excavating much larger sites where you actually see architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in Beit Saida, we have one of the largest, I think it's the largest gate from the 10th century BC in the world. Hmm. And the largest fortifications of that time period in the Near East. And it's that city is a city called Zed, and at the time period. That day it's called Beit Saida, but mm-hmm. at that time. And it was the capital of the Aramaic capital of Gshur.
Ah, okay.
So very, very interesting.
Yeah, so well, let's talk a little bit about Beit Saida.
Sure.
You said it's going everywhere from back to about the time of King David.
Yes.
Up to Roman times.
Yes, Roman period.
So were there sites in various levels?
Yes. So what's interesting about Beit Saida is that we have currently we've excavated over 6 levels, but the 2 main levels for which it's most known are the 10th century, what we call Beit Saida 5.
And this would be the high kingdom part of Israel.
Yes, the uh-huh. high kingdom part of Israel. Now, it wasn't a Davidic, what we call a Davidic
right.
city, but it was in the northern city of the Gshur, or the capital of the Gshurites, which is very interesting because we found their cultic area where they really, and we found a stele for their god, which is actually really quite beautiful, basalt steel with a horned god with bulls, bull horns on it. Obviously not a Judaic symbol. This I told you, this majestic gate and bastion. This whole stratum was ruined in 732 BC by the Assyrians that came and ruined the entire region, and it was totally burnt to the ground.
Now the gate you're talking about was it still sort of standing?
Yeah,
covered with dirt and mud.
Covered with a whole layer of ash, but basically standing as much as it could. Obviously, no wood remains. Basalt
but the stonework.
But the stonework was entirely standing, and when you excavate and you're excavating and you can still see the gate walls and the guards and the bastion, it's quite amazing. They found in one of the gates a whole cache of burnt wheat and barley seeds, totally burnt, around 300,000, which is quite amazing. Then they have a Hellenistic period built on top from the 3rd century B.C., which was mentioned in Josephus Flavius, and it was rebuilt by Herod's son, Herod Philips. And we have a lot of coins from that time period. It was built quite a lot. But what's really known for the Roman period, after the Herodian period, because it's mentioned in the New Testament, and that is a city. The city. It was a village. It was a fisherman's village at that time. I don't want to call it a city. But it was specifically known for the village where Andrew and Peter came from, and where Jesus is said to have performed some of his miracles, specifically feeding of the multitudes and curing of the blind man. And it was cursed, mentioned in Mark, because the people of Bethsaida didn't follow Jesus.
Right.
So specifically, as you know, people come there, and there's something even for people who are not religious or not Christians, that, you know, when you're excavating something like that, to have some kind of relationship to something that has some kind of historical value, it's very special.
So now how big was Bethsaida? Did it fluctuate over that 1,000-year period?
Well, two things are very interesting from the environmental perspective, from my perspective, and also from historical issues. A, it fluctuated in size very, very much. But B, obviously, I just mentioned it was a fisherman village. But today it's about 1.5 kilometers from the Sea of Galilee. So obviously it wasn't on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. Well, today it isn't. But
was it at one point?
And exactly. And the question is, was it at one point? And if so, how? And that is one of the environmental questions that are burning and we're trying to answer.
I would think that would be fairly easy to see, like a sediment level from underneath the lake or sea, if you will, at some point, which would be pretty discernible. Or is it not?
It's not so much. And so the question is, was there a main change in precipitation, for example, during the Roman period? So was it drier today than it was then? So then the sea level had risen or fallen today compared to that time period. Was there a tectonic event, for example, that may have shifted the area? And we think today that it's probably a combination of several of those reasons. But when they brought me into the project and we brought to you into the entire project, part of that was in order to try and bring in this new rodent method, if I should say, and to see what we can contribute to that question.
Now, I would think in a lot of sites, rodents are like, eh.
Exactly. And you're absolutely correct. They're
throw it out.
Yeah, exactly. They're of no interest.
So this is a sort of a change.
And very, very special. Very, very special.
What's the acceptance rates from people who are actually working in the field where they would
They're very excited. I think they're extremely excited because it's the first time that we're doing it at this time period. And we're just beginning, so we don't really have a lot of results to talk about so far. But I'll give you a little anecdote that sounds a little interesting. In the Roman period, we found rodents in the area of the big question that I always ask is where you find the rodents, right? If you find the rodents in the kitchen, if you find them in the temple, if you find them in the silos, where do you find the rodents? So we found rodents only in the kitchen. We didn't find them in any other room. And we found them in the way they were, you can see how much digestion marks they have on them if they were deposited by a barn owl or by a different kind of animal. and they were digested very, very heavily, suggested that a mammalian, some kind of mammal, basically ate them, and it went through the entire digestive system, mostly a dog. So you can imagine a scenario, we can put together a scenario that we didn't have raptors in this kitchen depositing pellets, but rather some kind of dog. We know we had dogs in the Roman period in Bethsaida, and these were remains, you know, in this courtyard, not, you know, this courtyard area that weren't really cleaned up, and that's how the rodents were deposited. In the other rooms, they were very clean. You know, it's like I always say, in your bedroom, you always clean up the rodents. You always sweep them up. You don't leave them there. But in this courtyard, they were a little less hygienic, and the dogs were left to roam about. And this is interesting because it means to me that, you know, it shows you a little bit more of the life events that occurred in that time period. It gives you a little sense of the day-to-day activities that occurred.
Do we have any idea of whether dogs were used just to basically control the rodent population?
That could have been. We don't have any cats. Hmm. So it's very interesting. We don't have any cats. All the mice that we found were all house mice. So, you know, we don't have any wild
country mice,
and so so we don't have any sense of infestation. For example, during the Roman periods, when I was sampling down right now in the Iron Age period from last summer, just like I expected, we didn't find anything so far in the big, you know, Iron Age gates. But that's because we're looking at areas that I expected would have been cleaned every day. I'm hoping to go back this summer with students. I'm hoping we have some students coming, and I encourage anybody who wants to come, students from TU, and anybody from the public is also welcome to contact me.
So this could be a great way to like spend a week maybe excavating.
Yeah, at the excavating.
And then spend another week touring Israel.
I just want to tell people exactly how we do it. So it's a really great excavation in the sense that we really incorporate studying just about the culture. We do the daily excavation, and then in the evening we always have some kind of class about the topic and general things when we learn how to analyze the ceramics and the bone tools.
Now, is this these classes specialized for anthropology majors?
No, very, very open for the public. We always have people.
It's like ranger talks.
Yeah, ranger talks. And we always have people come from all over the age groups, you know, all over the world, which is really great. And if people are worried about the language, everybody speaks English, so it's not a problem. And then people usually go and tour Israel or tour the area, depending on their mood, which is absolutely great.
My guest today is Dr. Miriam Bellmaker, an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Tulsa. She's hoping to go back to Bethsaida with a group of Tulsans interested in excavating this site, which was it's up on the Sea of Galilee, so it's the northern part of Israel.
Yes.
And it's was active from around the time of King David through the Roman times.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. But this is not your only excavation site that you're working on. You have a number that you've worked on. But let me talk about another area of emphasis is looking at Neanderthals, which is a totally misunderstood human predecessor, modern human predecessor.
One of our cousins, I should say.
One of our cousins. And one of the sites is Amud Cave. Now, this is in the Middle East again.
It's in Israel. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very interesting. What I've been working on Amud Cave is, and recently published a paper a few years ago with the excavator of Amud Cave, Dr. Ella Chovers from the Hebrew University. And I've looked at the rodents of Amud Cave as we talked before. Mm-hmm. And there, the question we asked was, why did the Neanderthals die out in the Middle East at the stage that they had died out around 40,000 years ago?
How does that compare to, say, Western Europe?
They died out much earlier.
In the Middle East?
In the Middle East.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in Western Europe, the last Neanderthals survived till about 28,000 years ago. And a lot of hypotheses, you know, have come about specifically because modern humans arrived in the Middle East around 40,000 years ago, and there's a lot of questions regarding, was it climate change? Was it this interaction with modern humans? And so on and so forth. So we tried to tackle the climate change hypothesis, and we used rodents, you know, as my specialty. And what we suggested is that climate was not the culprit, that people had suggested previously that there was this big cold snap around 45,000 that was, you know, extremely hard, a hardship on the Neanderthals and very difficult for them to sustain this really, you know, it's called the Heinrich V event. And we showed that the rodents survived it wonderfully, that they didn't really care. Mm-hmm. And so if rodents could survive the Heinrich V event, we thought the Neanderthals could do it probably as well, and that they were probably as adapted to cold as the rodents were.
Now, you had another group of humans migrating from Africa.
Yes.
And probably through the Levant again.
Yes,
at this
exactly.
particular time. So is it competition?
Well, we don't know at this stage if it's competition or if it's, you know, some kind of inbreeding. We have some genetic evidence that there's inbreeding, a combination of the two. I'm also working at a site called Mughal Hamama in Jordan and working on the rodents there. And we've suggested this site today is in a desert area. And I've recently presented in San Francisco with my colleague there, Dr. Aaron Stutz from Emory University, that at that time, at 45,000 years ago, that area had squirrels and it was wet and had trees.
Wow.
And so if you're looking at a total climate change compared to today, much wetter, you know, we have to think of a lot of different scenarios of how we're looking at the interaction. So perhaps Neanderthals living in the desert had to deal with a lot of different things from the way we think about the region today.
Mm. Now, it sounds like from what you're talking about, these collaborations, it's like you're kind of like the specialist they bring in to sort of look at the rodent population at various dig sites that help sort of hone in on the answers they're trying to look at about the ultimate site there.
Yes, I do that. In a lot of collaborations, that's the way it works. Mm-hmm. Because I have a very, very unique specialty that I can answer and that they can't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I actually run my own excavation in Armenia in a site called Gor Haik. I'm currently working on a site that's my own, that I'm actually directing the excavation. And this site, we didn't know what to expect when we went to excavate it last summer.
Now let me ask you, what made you choose this particular site in Armenia?
The site chose me. I always say sites choose you and not vice versa. I was invited by the director of this group in the Ministry of Culture that he was excavating the region. And he's an expert in Bronze Age Armenia. He's mm-hmm. not a Paleolithic specialist. And he found these obsidian Stone Age remains.
And so he was just digging around and goes, I need somebody
exactly.
that has expertise in an older age.
So he invited me because he knew me from another collaboration. So I went to excavate, and we found a site, this Gor Haik, that is 100% obsidian remains, only obsidian. It looks like what we call an upper Paleolithic site. And which looks like, as I said, because we haven't finished the analysis, the earliest stage of modern humans which left Africa and replaced Neanderthals. So there's no Neanderthal tools at the site. There's only these modern human remains. Now, right now, we're in the process of doing further analysis to confirm this. I'll be able to come back maybe soon with more results. But right now, this is what I can say. Unfortunately, there's no rodent remains at the site, so I'm only looking at the lithics right now. But hey, if we go back in the summertime, maybe we'll be able to find rodents.
Now, this is the other part that's really hard, is getting permission to even come into an area.
Yes, exactly. So that's...
Why is that political or is it...
No, it's the administrative authority for every site is the responsibility of the country. So I, for example, to excavate in Armenia, need to receive permission from the Armenian government. To excavate in Israel, I need to receive permission from the Israeli government and so on and so forth, from Jordan. And it just takes, you have to have a collaboration with a local person, which I do. And sometimes the politics, the winds blow the other way.
Is there a sort of a, I mean, I would think the same thing would happen in the United States, where it's like, obviously, well, we have plenty of, you know, sites that we want Americans to work on.
Yes. And yeah, you always have to work with somebody to collaborate with a local archaeologist. I mean, mm-hmm, I work with a local Armenian on the Armenian sites. And obviously in Bayside, as I mentioned, we have a consortium with 11 universities, but we work with an Israeli. We don't, you know, waltz in one afternoon. All the material belongs officially that we find belong to Israel or belong to Armenia. We don't come and take them back to the United States. We can study them, and, you know, that's another advantage of studying rodents. Most people care less about the rodents. You can more easily bring them back to Tulsa, which is another point. You know, we actually have here in Tulsa and TU a lot of some of the original rodents, because on loan, not they're not here for eternity, but on loan, so we can have students are more than welcome to come study them. Hmm. And these are original materials from all around the world.
Yeah. Well, we wish you great success with that. How do people get information if they want to go to Bayside? Is there a particular set of dates they have to be?
Well, right now is the crucial time, because they can search for it on the website of the Center for Global Education. Yeah. It's over there. If they want more information, they can come speak to me and find me on TU website, Department of Anthropology. They're more than welcome to come speak to me directly.
Is there dates throughout the summer, or is it a particular
there's
time? There's
dates throughout the summer. It's all on the website. It's throughout June and the end of May, and there's three sessions, and you can go for one session, which is 2 weeks. You can go through more sessions. You can go for half a session. It's really extremely flexible. But if they want specific information, they can come speak to me, and I'm always available.
All right. We'll have a link on our website as well. Dr. Miriam Bellmaker, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Paleoanthropologist Dr. Miriam Bellmaker, an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Tulsa, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. If you'd like more information about that Beit Zaida dig in northern Israel this summer, you can visit the Center for Global Education at the University of Tulsa's website, or call 918-631-3759. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed any of our recent programs, they're available online anytime to listen to on demand at our website, publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa and you can search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.